Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. Filling in for Reuben Stern, I'm Raymond Tunkakar. A report issued earlier this year says the U.S. is lagging in subjects known as STEM fields. That acronym stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics. The report, from the President's Council of Advisors in Science and Technology, says that over the next decade, the U.S. needs to produce 1 million more STEM professionals in order to retain its historic preeminence in science and technology. It all raises a number of questions. How do you cultivate an interest in science and math? How do you prevent college students from abandoning majors in STEM fields? And how do you address the gender disparity in the sciences? Joining me on today's show are three experts to help explore these questions. Troy Sadler is the director of the MU Science Education Center. The center encourages collaboration between scientists, science educators, and others. Troy Sadler, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Troy Hogg is the principal of the Thomas Hart Benton Elementary School. Last year, the school transitioned into a STEM school with an increased focus on science, technology, engineering, and math. Troy Hogg, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Craig Adams is the practical arts coordinator for Columbia Public Schools. In that role, he helps develop ways to integrate technology into the classroom. Welcome, Craig Adams.
Glad to be here.
And we hope to hear from you in the audience as well. For the parents in our audience, how do you get your kids interested in math and science? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can also join our online chat. I just want to open the question out to with a broad question. Why are we seeing this gap in STEM fields? I mean, in the intro I mentioned that the Office of the President said that we needed 1 million more STEM professionals in the coming decade. What's the problem? Is there a lack of interest in STEM?
I think it's an issue that's reflective of society in terms of the fields that are important, are growing, are in need, are economic drivers for our society. And those fields are science, technology, engineering. And so this call from the president is a push to develop the next generation of scientists and technologists and engineers, mathematicians here in the U.S. The other part of this trend is that we're seeing other nations such as India and China produce a lot of scientists and engineers, and to remain competitive, to keep an innovative and competitive edge, I think we're seeing out of the president's office some leadership around the push for having more U.S. students interested in STEM fields and prepared to move in those directions.
Okay. Well, what are some of the obstacles to getting students into the STEM fields at the elementary level?
I think that at our school, it's just an awareness of those positions and those careers that are out there. While it seems like everyone knows technology, engineering, math, what those jobs might be, the students in my building don't. They're not aware of that. They don't have family members who are in those careers already, so they're not as familiar with them. And if you've never had that exposure, you don't even know what it is, you're not going to go that direction. I know that for myself, I didn't have any engineers in my own family, so I didn't know what an engineer was when I was growing up. It wasn't an option for me. So I think it's a matter of just, first of all, building that awareness of these are the kind of careers that are out there that you can do if you enjoy science, technology, engineering, and math.
Hmm. At the junior high, middle school, high school level, where I'm involved in, that's exactly right. It's about awareness, and at that level, kids know that they like to take things apart, or they like to, I like walking in the woods, or I like doing these things, but they don't really know what the professions that go along with those things. So, it's an awareness. It's not knowing what's out there. So
I just want to add, I mean, I think an important part of this conversation is, you know, the point of innovative programs like what we see at Benton, it's not about necessarily turning a second grader into a computer scientist, but the research shows that early experiences in STEM areas and developing a sense of interest, a sense of self-efficacy early on, as early as the primary grades in elementary school and middle school and some high school, those experiences are critical to having individuals persist in that interest and be ready to move into STEM fields or choose majors that align with STEM disciplines down the road. So, you know, we can see kind of the issue at the point of choosing majors in college and choosing careers, but you can't necessarily fix it then. You really there's good research that suggests that those early experiences are really critical.
Well, earlier you mentioned that part of the difficulty is, you know, actually exposing students to what's available to them. How do you get that message out there that, you know, how do you, like, introduce engineering to a student?
I know that at Benton, we had a STEM showcase at the beginning of the school year last year. We invited several people from the community, different professions, scientists, medical field, engineers. Our coordinators all came and helped as well. And they just literally for, you know, a couple hours, the students rotated from person to person, just from area to area, just to get a taste of what's out there, just to get a little bit of a peak of interest in it. It was really just, for some of our students, it's the first time they've ever had a conversation with a doctor, besides just going to visit the doctor, but actually talking to the doctor about what they do and how they do that and what kind of math they have to have and science background they have to have. So it's really making that connection between the people who are out there in these careers with the students who are here wanting to learn more about it.
I just came from Shakespeare's Pizza, where a group of my students are doing an entrepreneurship activity. And, you know, several of them, you talk to the kids before they went to this activity, and they're talking about, I want to start a business, or I want to go into the military, I want to go do this. Well, a good portion of them wanted to start some type of business, some type of entrepreneurship activity. So, but they didn't really know anything about starting a business. So what does it take to run a business? How do you know, if I'm going to have employees, what am I going to do with the employees? So these kids are actually over in Shakespeare's right now making pizzas, doing a little mock interview, you know, those types of things. So they're actually out in the community. And I guess my point is, I think we need to get our kids out and see what's out there, you know, get to talk to the public. We need the public's help on this to actually get them either into the classroom or get our kids out into their fields to see kind of what's out there. What are some of our options? Because so many kids don't really know what they want to do when they, you know, what are they going to do when they leave us at the age of 18? What happens then? So,
And so it's like just learning through experience and by engaging with members of the community.
And I would say, I mean, that idea of learning by being engaged in an activity, by doing things, that's important for in the classroom as well. You know, a lot of students and adults, I mean, if we think about our own experiences learning science and math, well, we might think about some classrooms where we sat and, you know, we took notes, or we did, you know, 100 math problems, and while those kinds of things, doing some math problems and taking some notes in a science classroom, is not necessarily a bad thing all the time, but doing it all the time probably is a bad thing, in that we know that if we use those learning spaces to engage kids in some other activities in addition to those kinds of things to support not just a relatively brief memorization of some ideas, but really engaging with the ideas, being able to do something with ideas, apply those skills, those practices, that those kinds of activities are really critical for putting our students in places to be successful.
It's pointing out to the kids also that science is science outside of science class.
Right.
Science is science when it's in practical arts classes or it's in math classes. It's science is science no matter where. And that's one of the things I see. I teach a class called engineering, where I team teach with a science teacher, and kids will go from science down to my room and they'll have the concept, but they won't feel, at first, they don't feel like they can apply it there because it's not really, it's not in the same classroom and it's not in the same area. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with math. Math, they know the math, they know the geometry, they know what they need to know. But when they come to that engineering class, sometimes they don't make that connection that, oh, I can right. use these tools that I already have. So it's getting them outside that silo.
At Benton, when we were trying to have that conversation about what is STEM, what's it going to look like, what does this mean, and a lot of people think it's some sort of a separate curriculum or something different, and it's really not. It's how you teach the kids. It's how you get the kids more involved and engaged in what they're doing so that they're problem solvers, and they can sort through that process of, I've got a problem, I'm going to brainstorm how I'm going to find a solution to that problem, I'm going to implement something, I'm going to test it, see if it works, and if it doesn't, I'm going to go back and do it again. And you can do that process, like you said, everywhere, whether you're in art class or music class or even when you're reading a book, you have to problem solve as you're reading. So mm-hmm. that's kind of our take on it too at Benton, is teaching in a different way, not necessarily a different curriculum, but just teaching the kids how to tackle anything that's in front of them.
Hmm. Well, I want to get back to that, but I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I am Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we're talking about STEM education, which stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. Our guests in the studio today are Troy Sadler, director of the MU Science Education Center, Troy Hogg, who's principal of the Thomas Hart Benton Elementary School, and Craig Adams, the Practical Arts Coordinator for Columbia Public Schools. And for you in our audience, how do you think schools can improve their teaching of math and science? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. We'd like to remind you that Intersection is presented as streaming video during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2, online at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2, online at kbia.org. So how would you engage, we're talking about engaging students in the STEM fields. How would you engage someone in math? How would you take that approach to like experiential learning for a math problem, for example?
I think for students, rather than doing that 100 page of problems, you're really letting them dig deeper into the problems that they have there. You're letting them have that opportunity to use those manipulatives that they need to be able to solve those problems, and also help students realize that there's more than one way to solve a problem, not just the traditional algorithm that we tend to rely on, but we really want the kids to truly understand the math problem. And there are many kids who can memorize, but they don't understand the numbers behind it. They don't really have the number sense, because all they've simply done is memorize the algorithms, and they don't really understand the numbers behind it. And I think that's where you have to dig deeper with the kids.
Hmm. I would say in science or math, if we move away from the idea that students need to learn or memorize this fact or this piece of information, but rather gain the ability to use these ideas as tools to do something, to mm-hmm. solve something, that's a much more powerful way of thinking about what it is that we're teaching students. These are conceptual tools that can help them in an engineering situation. It can help them in a financial situation, a health situation, and those are the kinds of activities that we want to engage students in, I think.
Okay, we actually have a question from the chat room for Troy Sadler. Do you have children, and if so, do you try to integrate science into activities at home?
Yes, I have three children. Well, one will be starting kindergarten, and I have twins that will be in third grade next year. And, we try to integrate some science and math at home. And I think it's about providing lots of experiences and opportunities and to use numbers, to use ideas, to talk science, to share ideas. So, sure. I mean, we don't go through a formal curriculum at home, no. we certainly do try to get our kids thinking and challenging them with ideas and using numbers in their everyday life and getting back to what Troy was talking about in terms of thinking about mathematics in terms of really developing a number sense. I think that's an important part.
Hmm. And so, it sounds like that certainly would help with retention. Have there been long-term studies kind of assessing that type of learning over time?
Well, when you say that type of learning,
or that type of teaching, rather, one in which it's it's less learning by rote and more by actual practice and experience. So
sure.
Problem solving, for example.
Sure. You know, there's a relatively recent report that came out, Taking Science to School, which is a comprehensive review of research in the area of science education, cognitive sciences, psychology, that really looks at, you know, what is it that kids know, what can they do, what can they learn, and you know, what's the state of the field for learning science, and it touches on some math and engineering as well. And I think if you look at that report, there's a lot of evidence from a lot of different places, some longitudinal studies, some classroom-based intervention studies, some kind of clinical studies, clinical environments, that do provide good support for this idea of engaging students meaningfully with ideas and practices and the positive benefits that can be associated.
Craig Adams, would you mind going into some of the programs Columbia Public Schools does? It's my understanding that you actually there's actually a trip. Students are going to Yellowstone National Park.
They're going to the Grand Tetons right now. They're, okay. Mike Sidlowski is taking our science coordinator is taking a group of 75 students by bus to the Grand Tetons. And he's done this before, where he came from Rockwood, and he's done it several years down there. But they're going out, and they're backpacking, and they're doing science in the Tetons right now. It's a fantastic trip. In fact, he took our math coordinator with him, and so she's on the trip too with him. And I'm anxious to see how this all turns out. I've heard some of the stories. The kids were really excited about it, and the parents that are going with them are really excited too. So that's something new that we're doing in Columbia Public Schools right now.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Mm-hmm. I do want to ask you, Troy Hogg. Mm-hmm. I mean, since Benton transitioned into a STEM school, what have you been seeing? I guess, well, to start out, was it a welcome transition for all the teachers?
I think it was. We were pretty excited about it. It gave us a purpose and a direction for the school. I think we've been overwhelmed a little bit. It really snowballed quicker than we anticipated. When we said we were going to become a STEM school, just the overwhelming response we got from the university, from the engineering department, the science department, who all want to come and help us do this really well, which we're really excited about. You know, we are elementary teachers, so we tend to do math, you know, we do all subject areas, so we tend to do everything kind of at the surface. We don't get real deep because we're not specialists in any one area per se. So it's been really helpful to have those experts coming in the fields of science and engineering and math and just to help us out. So it's been really, 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 really exciting.
Mm-hmm. So in addition to the teachers teaching, more focused on STEM, you also have instructors from the community coming in to supplement that?
There was a GK-12 grant from the science department at MU that they brought in two science graduate students who worked with my fourth grade class and my fifth grade class all year long, 10 hours a week. They were there about 2 hours every day and sat there side by side with the classroom teacher teaching them. Also took the kids through some really practical experiences, kind of like not the Grand Teton trip, I wish we could get that, but they had, the students actually had to write a grant, a mini research grant that they had. It was a competitive grant with other schools, and they had to get funded, and they received the funding for that, thank goodness. And they bought some GPS units that they used to go down to Stevens Park, and they did a study of squirrels and their habitat, and they were tracking them with GPS to see where the squirrels were, and really fascinating. I mean, it was really a good experience, a practical experience for the kids. That's what I think is really exciting, when you really get the kids out there in science, and not just sitting in the classroom, reading the textbook, taking the notes, but really getting in there and doing it. They learn a lot more from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it answers the question, why do I need this? I mean, I know teachers hear this all the time from kids. Why do I need this? When am I ever going to use this? Mm-hmm. And if they're actually using it, they're actually out in the community using science, using math, using whatever, you know, the social skills, whatever. It answers that question. You are going to need this, and this is where you're going to use it. Mm-hmm. It's a tool.
The other really fantastic thing about this kind of program is that, you know, science, we often think about science, and it's a reflection of the way many of us were taught, as this collection of facts. But science is really about this process of going out and answering questions. Mm-hmm. And so by giving kids an opportunity to go out and conduct their own investigation, and that they have a hand in designing around the squirrels, and mm-hmm. I'm not quite sure what the investigation was, but I suspect that it was the students that had a hand in shaping what that study was going to be all about, and what were they going to measure, and what were they interested in, what kinds of questions were they and were they going to ask, and how are those questions going to be answered? Well, that's what science is, much more so than you know, some list of facts, static facts. It's a much more dynamic process. And so by giving kids opportunities to actually be involved in that process and not just learning about the process, mm-hmm. I think is critical.
Well, I just want to remind listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we're talking about STEM education. That stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. Our guests in the studio today are Troy Sadler, director of the MU Science Education Center, Troy Hogg, who's the principal of Thomas Hart Benton Elementary School, and Craig Adams, the Practical Arts Coordinator for Columbia Public Schools. And for the scientists in the audience, why did you choose your profession? Why do you think more people aren't pursuing STEM professions? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. Well, through these programs, it sounds like, yes, you are developing a better, like more, I suppose, more critical thinking skills, and you're getting students to think like scientists. How do you ensure a well-rounded education, though? How do you ensure that, for example, the language arts aren't, left by the wayside?
Well, it was really interesting because when we said we were going to become a STEM school, everyone said, well, what about reading and writing? Well, like, we're not going to teach reading and writing. I mean, of course we're going to teach reading and writing. But what we are doing is we're pulling more of that nonfiction literature into what we're doing. So the kids are reading about what they've been learning about in science. It's more meaningful then. It means more to them. Kids tend to like to write real, true stories, not fiction all the time. And they tend to read lots of fiction, but they tend to prefer to write nonfiction. And so we're getting them more opportunities to read the nonfiction. We were really lucky last year. Benton received a $5,000 grant from the Laura Bush Foundation to purchase more nonfiction text to support STEM. And I found out last week we got another $4,000 this year from the Laura Bush Foundation. So we're getting more. So we've used that to purchase more nonfiction books, e-books, just different mediums too, for the students to be able to access that literature as well.
And some of the STEM curriculum that we purchased for Benton and for mm-hmm. for the rest of schools last year was engineering is elementary, and it's put together by the Museum of Technology in Boston. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they do in that is there's a literacy piece that goes with it. There's a text material that comes with each one of these activities. So it might be on, let's say it's on phonics or something like that. Well, the textbook or the book for that the kids read with this activity has geography built into it, because it's written about a let's say it's a girl who lives in Africa who has this phonics concept that she's trying to work through. Well, it's all in that storybook kind of application. And so it works in social studies, it works in literacy, it works in reading. I mean, it kind of has the whole package, but it also has the science, technology, engineering, and math piece built in too. So I thought it was a really well-rounded package. It was the best that I had seen. So
what we're trying to get away from is that segmented teaching, because real life isn't reading for 30 minutes a day or math for an hour a day. It's all day long, everything. And so really integrating all of those subject areas back and forth, including music, including art, pulling all of those things in together. So the kids do see those connections. When they're in one area, they go, oh, that's what we're doing in science right now. And, oh, that's what we're doing in math right now. They're making those connections. That's really exciting to see them do. Because then you know that it's sticking with them. They've got it, because mm-hmm. they're making the connections. We're not making it for them.
And is that the ultimate goal for this transition to STEM?
Sure, I think so. I think we want our kids to be able to, again, attack any situation and go through that process of solving those problems that they have, wherever it's at. Whether it's in art class or music class, they can think things through, not just recite information and facts back to us.
And is this type of program common? Not only in mid-Missouri, but just nationally.
Elementary STEM schools are very, very rare. In fact, I had to take I took a group of teachers to Minnesota last year to actually visit a STEM elementary school, because they're very rare. They're a little bit more common, I think, in middle school and high school. I don't know if Dr.
Yeah, I'd say across the nation, there's a handful of high school STEM focused high schools, more than a handful, but you know they're not, there's not lots of them, but they're more prevalent at the high school level, a little less prevalent at middle school, and then there's a big drop off, many fewer at the elementary level.
Well, and what are some of the challenges towards instituting a STEM program at the elementary level? Do you want to take that, Troy Hawk?
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like a really daunting task.
It is a daunting task. We don't know if we realized how daunting it was until we undertook it. But you know what? It's also exciting. It's been really, really exciting. I think for elementary, again, I think the hardest thing for us is that we do teach everything. We do teach reading and writing and math and social studies and science, and we're not specialists in any one area. So we have to kind of get past that comfort level of it, because we had to realize that it's not about, again, about the facts. It's not about how much I know about science. It's how can I teach my kids to get into science and to really appreciate it and to understand it. And we can do that. We can to help teach them the process and how to walk through things. But stepping away from us, realizing we don't have to be the experts. We don't have to know everything there is in science and tell you everything. We're going to teach you how to get that information, you know, how to get on using the technology to get the information and how to discern good information from bad information. Because technically, if you want to know a fact, you just got to get online and Google it right now and you can find that fact. But you have to be able to understand, wait a minute, is that true or is that not true? Is that good information or is that not good information? And I think that's what we want to teach our kids to be able to do.
Hmm. And were the students kind of accepting of that transition? Because presumably throughout most of their lives they'd been learning a certain type of way, and right. Now they're experiencing just this complete shift in the way they're being taught.
They love it. They love it. They really do. They're really excited to get to more hands-on, more involved in the process. We're asking them more questions because we want them to come up with the answers and not just provide them with it. So we're asking them more things, and they're took a little bit, you know, to get them to want, like, there's not a right answer. Like, you just want me to just say what I think? We're like, yeah, that's it. You just tell us what you think would happen. You know, that's kind of a challenge for some kids to get past that there's not a right answer necessarily.
I took a group of my students at Jeff. I teach at a junior high school here in town. And I took a group of my students over there. We did magnetism activity where we did electromagnets and permanent magnets. And we actually built, you know, we wound up wire around a nail and took batteries and picked stuff up with it. And the kids, it's playing. I mean, that's what they do. That's what they like to do. That's what they do best. I mean, they're just playing, but they're actually learning while they're playing. So we were just fascinated by the fact that they were just so eager to get in and see how does that magnet work, and can I make a better magnet? Can I make a bigger magnet? Can I make my magnet better than your magnet? And so, you know, it was that sense of play. But they were just so excited to be doing those activities. And I think it was a kind of an eye-opener for my students, too. It's
like, and I think in general it's easier to deal with those kind of student issues about that transition to, oh, this is something new, this is a new style, new way of learning for us at the elementary level than it is if you integrate that at just start at the high school level without having had those experiences in formal education prior to that, or even much more difficult at the college level. Because at the college level, at a place like MU, for instance, I mean, you've got a lot of students that have been very successful throughout their academic careers, and many of them in a pretty traditional format. Mm-hmm. So then if you take those students and just change things up, it can be a real tough transition. So it's an easier transition, I think, with elementary school learners.
Okay. I just want to remind listeners that you are listening to Intersection. This is a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. On this week's show, we're talking about STEM education. STEM education standing for science, technology, education, mathematics, and ways to engage young people in those fields. Our guests today are Troy Sadler, director of the MU Science Education Center, Troy Hogg, who's the principal of Thomas Hart Benton Elementary School, and Craig Adams, the practical arts coordinator for Columbia Public Schools. And we'll be back after a short break. We'll be right back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungekar. On today's show, we're talking about STEM education, which stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. Our guests in the studio today are Troy Sadler, director of the MU Science Education Center, Troy Hogg, who's the principal of the Thomas Hart Benton Elementary School, and Craig Adams, the practical arts coordinator for Columbia Public Schools. And for you in our audience, what could universities do to promote enrollment in STEM courses? Share your thoughts, give us a call at 573-882-8925, or email intersection@kbia.org. Before the break, we were talking about the different types of STEM programs. Troy Sadler, you'd mentioned that it's really difficult to institute this from the student perspective at the college level, just because they've already been taught a certain way and it's hard to break old habits. What's the best time to, I suppose, start these programs? At what age level are students most responsive towards this?
Well, just having said what I said, it can be more difficult for learners that have been in the system, if you will, and have grown accustomed to a certain way of doing science and math class. Despite that, I mean, these kinds of innovative programs have been shown to be effective in lots of different settings. So it's not that I'm not trying to suggest that we shouldn't be doing this or we can't do this at higher levels. We can. But if the question is, you know, when should we be doing it? Where might we be able to get the most success? I'd say the earlier the better. An approach like Benton's approach, where you start with elementary students at the kindergarten, is a great place to start. If not earlier, let's get kids interested in science and math and thinking about science and math early, and let's support that interest and those ideas as they grow.
And has there been any research that kind of indicated that? For example, do most STEM professionals do they become engaged at younger levels or when they're older?
Well, there's an important study that was put out about 3 years ago that has gotten a fair amount of attention around this very question. You know, when it was kind of a study asking successful folks that were successful in science, technology, engineering, and math, when they became interested, what were the kind of pivotal experiences, and an awful lot of those individuals could tie their interest in science all the way back to an early elementary kind of experience. So that kind of a kernel of interest was planted way back when they were young children, and that was powerful enough to kind of sustain their ideas and interests and ultimately some career choices.
Well, I want to get into the role of standardized testing in all of this. How do standardized tests, relate to STEM courses? Are we at a point now where standardized tests, as we see it, actually do a good job of assessing science and math?
Anybody want that one?
So, I'll start. I mean, I'm sure we all have something to say about standardized testing. Any test can measure a certain number of things, and there are certain target practices, target ideas that some of which are more easily assessed than others. And I think it's really important to keep that in mind. So, standardized tests are really important and kind of influential. Have an influential place in our education system today, based on the accountability systems, No Child Left Behind, state accountability systems, teacher accountability systems. But we need to recognize that the kinds of tests that we tend to give kids, that we can give kids based on the economics of testing, are limited in what we can assess as in terms of what kids can know and do, and so in some ways I would argue that because of the pressures of having really high scores or supporting our students in achieving or getting really strong scores on these achievement tests, we have de-emphasized other things in the curriculum that don't show up on the test, or this suite of tests that we often give. And at the elementary level, there's for many years, the tests prioritized mathematics and language arts. Mm-hmm. And so what we saw is other aspects of the curriculum, science, social studies, the arts, those were all pushed out because of the importance of testing in math and language arts. And obviously there's nothing wrong with math and language arts. But if we're only testing a small part of what it is that we want students to be able to do and know, then we're really shrinking, and then that drives the curriculum. Then we're really shrinking what it is or how we engage our students.
And Troy Hogg, how has that historically played out at Benton?
We've not done real well on standardized testing. You know, there were two reasons why we implemented STEM at Benton. One is just our declining enrollment. We're a smaller school in the center of Columbia. Most of the new neighborhoods are on the outskirts of town, so the population just keeps moving out from the center. And so we needed to increase our enrollment. So that was the one reason that we got it. But the most important reason was to increase our student achievement. We see that our students weren't successful on the tests, regardless of the fact that we could teach them what they needed to learn, and they'd seem to have it 1 minute, but then by the end of the year for the state assessment, it seems like they didn't know it. And we're like, well, what happened? Because we know that based on all of our tests all the way through that you were doing well, you knew what you needed to know, but they weren't able to apply it at the end. So obviously the way we were teaching the kids wasn't working. So we needed to change something. So we really feel like this approach with STEM, putting more of the learning in the hands of the students, being more guides and facilitators for their learning is more important. So they actually have those skills that they need to be able to apply that knowledge, not just have the knowledge, because they weren't retaining that as well.
Well, that's why we do what we do, is so the kids can apply. Mm-hmm. It's not about the learning. I taught it to the kids. I taught that to them. Mm-hmm. Well, if they can't apply it, then it wasn't there. Right. They have to own it. And you know, that's one of the things with standardized tests is a lot of times they don't measure how much, and they look at this. Well, we want everybody to be here at this level, but they don't look at the growth mm-hmm. that's happened over the year. You know, we want everybody to be here, but if this student started out low, we progressed over a period of time. Well, a lot of times that's not looked at like the major score. So, mm-hmm. You know, I look at this standardized testing issue as, do I want a doctor that did really well on the tests, or do I want a doctor that can apply that knowledge and be a good physician? And I think we've taken out with the standardized testing, a lot of times we've, like you said, devalued a lot of those other things about mm-hmm. the application of these facts. And by emphasizing math and English, which are we need to definitely put an emphasis on that. But we also need to put an emphasis on all these other areas too. So we need to put an emphasis on science. We need to put an emphasis on the social skills too. So, you know, it's a difficult situation that you can't just put there's your standardized test and that's gonna answer everything. So,
well, how do you? It strikes me as being really difficult to negotiate, though, because standardized tests ultimately could play into how much funding the school mm-hmm. district gets mm-hmm. or how it's viewed in terms of success. But the STEM programs, I mean, they're promoting a certain way of thinking that might not be reflected on standardized tests. So how do you convince educators around the country that, you know, let's not look at standardized tests, let's look at long-term success? Have you heard any arguments being made in favor of that?
Oh, sure. I mean, there are lots of folks in the education community that would advocate that point of view. Whether or not that point of view popular among policymakers is up to question. I go back to what I at least was trying to say earlier. I mean, it's really important to keep in mind that tests can measure, any test can measure a limited range of ideas or competencies or skills, and we need to keep that in mind. And so when we make tests, you know, these high stakes tests, where we have one test or a couple of tests that we say, okay, well, this is the metric by which we judge success of a teacher, of a school, of a student. We need to be pretty careful about that, because I can. The one thing's for sure, that one test or that two tests, that's not going to cover everything that we want students to know or to be able to do. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of the things that we've discussed earlier in terms of some of the projects that are going on in Columbia Public Schools and at Benton, there's a lot of things going on, positive learning experiences for our students that aren't showing up on a standardized test per se.
Well, but what would the new metric be then that would replace standardized tests to convince policymakers that this is the right way to go?
Well, that's the problem. I mean, there's not a metric. And I mean, you're pointing it out. I mean, on one hand, we really value this notion of accountability and having metrics so that we can show student growth and we can show students have met this benchmark. And I would argue that, well, we really need a change in mindset around what qualifies as success in schools. And I'm happy for standardized tests to be a part of that conversation. But I think we need to move away from the idea that standardized tests are the only way that we document change and growth and success.
Okay. Well, I want to ask, Troy Sadler, have you seen any research about how students best learn in the STEM fields? At what age, what methods work best with students?
It's kind of a loaded question. Yeah. So yeah. I mean, there's a lot of research out there that you know targets different age groups, different grade levels, different subjects. I don't have a single answer to tell you that this works for everyone or this works best for all learners. The fact of the matter is that learners are quite diverse and they have different interests. They have different experiences coming into our schools and classrooms, and so there's not one best method for any set of students. So I know that's not the response that you wanted, but there is a lot of research out there that can show. Different approaches and techniques that work for students with different kinds of backgrounds, but there's not a silver bullet for STEM education or any education for that matter. It's too complicated of an issue in terms of the population, the learners to begin with. We're talking about STEM, so we're talking about a wide swath of material and ideas from science, technology, engineering, and math. So there's a lot of different approaches out there, I think.
Okay. Well, throughout our conversation, we're talking about exposing young students, young people, just to the possibilities that are open to them and cultivating this way of thinking that's more about problem solving as opposed to memorization. How do you combat the in speaking with other people, they mentioned that, you know, once you reach the middle school level, you see some students drop out of the STEM fields because maybe there's a lack of interest, there's a perception that it's not cool. How do you combat that? How do you keep that interest and curiosity going?
I think one of the things that you do is, you know, I ask my students in my engineering class. I'll say every year, you know, I have a lot of students that are interested in engineering. I'll say, "What's your favorite class?" "Well, this is my favorite class, Mr. Adams." "Well, what's your least favorite class?" "Well, I don't like math." "Well, what do you want to be?" "I want to be an engineer." Well, sometimes they don't see the connection and they don't see that they need that. They need that piece. So I think it goes back to awareness. It goes back to, you know, we take the Explore test in the eighth grade, and the kids can they put on the Explore test what they're interested in. They say, "Well, I'm interested in engineering." Well, then it'll actually show you where you are on the chart. It'll show you where your skill set is in math and science. And if your skill set for math and science doesn't line up for what you're actually interested in, well, that's good information. And I think it's at that level, it's about information. If I know that I need more skills, I need more math and science to do what I want to do when I leave high school, I think that's one way to combat that is by giving that information to the kids and to the parents and letting them decide, you know, if this is where you want to go, this is what you want to do, this is what you're going to need. So I think awareness.
Okay, I want to remind listeners that you're listening to Intersection. It's a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Filling in for Ruben Stern, I'm Raymond Tungakar. On today's show, we're talking about STEM education. That acronym stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. Our guests in the studio today are Troy Sadler, director of the MU Science Education Center, Troy Hogg, who's the principal of Thomas Hart Benton Elementary School, and Craig Adams, the practical arts coordinator for Columbia Public Schools. And for you in our audience, what do you think could be done to promote interest among middle schoolers in the STEM fields? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. One other question I had is, well, it's a two-part question. Is there a gender disparity in the STEM fields? And if there is, what could be done to address that?
We've noticed in just our research of STEM education and STEM fields that there are underrepresented minorities are underrepresented in the STEM fields, as well as women. And so one thing that we've tried to do at Benton is we're trying to begin a GEMS program, G-E-M-S, so it's Girls in Engineering, Math, and Science. And we've partnered with the American Association of University Women to set up some mentoring programs with our students. So we have these ladies who are in STEM fields, who are in STEM careers, and not all STEM careers, but they are definitely career-minded ladies, and they have paired up with some of our girls in our school, usually our fourth and fifth grade girls, and just showing them possibilities and talking to them more about those careers. Really trying to separate the girls out from the boys a little bit, in a sense, because I will tell you that in a classroom, generally speaking, girls tend to take the back seat when it comes to boys in science and math. They kind of step aside and aren't as willing to put themselves out there. But when it's just a room full of girls having conversations about science, they're all over it. They're just so excited about it. We see the same thing with math. We see the same thing with our sports on the playground. If it's just the girls playing, they're more than willing to try anything. But if a guy's there, they tend to kind of step back and let them do it. And we don't want that to happen. We really want to push our girls forward too. And if they're interested in science or math, then we want them to go for it.
Hmm. Well, what causes that reluctance to speak up in class or
I think it's society. I think it's the nature of our society where we have programmed girls to think that they're not as good in math or science as boys are, or they're not as good in sports as boys are. I think we've programmed in our society our kids to think that way, and we're trying to break that thinking and say, you can do whatever you want to do. No matter your gender, no matter your ethnicity, you can do whatever you want to do. We're trying to open up our kids' eyes to that possibility.
It's interesting. The class that I teach, I have two classes of 25, and out of that class, five of those kids will be girls, and those five girls are usually some of my best engineers, some of my best students, and that goes for physics and engineering both. They're some of my best students in that class. But I get walking down the hallway, I'll get a lot of kids that'll say, girls that'll say, I wanted to take your class. Well, why didn't you take my class? Well, I didn't want to get in. All those boys are in there, and I didn't want to get in there with that. So it's an interesting phenomenon. We struggle to try to get more girls into that class. I think one of the things we need to do is get more women involved in my area and into engineering. We need more women involved in engineering, and one of my teachers that teaches at West Junior, Julie Purcell, she has no problem getting girls in her class. In fact, her class are 50-50, boys to girls. And so I think that's one way to possibly to combat that.
Mm-hmm. We actually have a caller on the line, David from Columbia. Are you there, David?
I am. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, certainly.
A couple of quick ideas, and not just to take your responses off the air. First of all, regarding standardized testing, I think we should be cautious and not confuse limitations of Missouri's assessment program or the MAP test, which is a specific state measure which involves a standardized test, or NCLB and how it uses test data, and the concept of standardized testing itself. For instance, the statement that from a given standardized test you cannot show student growth in learning, that's true, of course. You would need two data points, a pretest and a post-test, and you would need to show that Timmy learned something in between. The MAP test does not require those two data points, and that's a flaw of the MAP test. NCLB does not require those two data points, and that's a flaw of NCLB. That's not a flaw of standardized testing. Standardized testing is, in fact, not about measuring students, ultimately. It's about informing instruction. And my hat's really off to the principal at Benton who embedded in his commentary the statement that, there was a point when they were teaching, but they weren't seeing the dividend of student learning in the test measurements, and so they looked at how to change instruction, and that's the right way to go. All of that discussion is a different animal from the question of how do we inspire kids to be engaged in MET subject matter. And by the way, I would say that the state does measure student achievement not only in language arts and mathematics, but also in science and also in social studies, and has for 3 years. But the idea of engaging students more in the subject matter is key. If you engage all students, not just boys, but also girls, you'll see better dividends. One way I think we should do that is to distribute out scientific concepts, mathematical concepts, engineering concepts, into the other disciplines. I was recently reading the biography of the great physicist Paul Dirac, and he was describing his education in Northern Europe just after the turn of the 20th century. And they would have an art class, and they would be required to draw a kind of machine. And then they would have a mathematics class, and they would be required to study the equations along which that machine functioned. And then they would have a laboratory class in which the machine would be applied in front of them, and they would see its effects. And then they would have a language arts class in which they would narratively describe how that machine had worked and how so on and so forth. You see, this interdisciplinary approach, which then appeals to all thinkers and all students, not just boys who happen to be interested in science and maybe not interested in math. That's my two or three points, and I'll take your responses off the air. Thanks very much.
I love that approach. I think that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to integrate it throughout all of those subject areas so the kids really do get a better grasp and understanding of it. It's not so isolated. So I love that comment by the caller, because I think that's exactly what we're trying to strive for.
And to the point that it's not a failing of standardized testing, but just in the way it's conducted, would you agree to that?
I would. Yeah. I would. I think you have to take into account, like you said, the two points of pretest and post-test. You have to look at and we can do that somewhat. We can look at what they were, where they were the year before and where they were the year after. But I do think that we need to look at growth, you know, where the student starts and where they end up. And there is learning taking place. And, you know, where is that learning taking place? I think I made some excellent points. As far as tearing down the silos and opening those classroom walls up and having students learn about the arts and learn about engineering and math and science and everything, you know, interdisciplinary, looking at it from a different lens, I think that's an excellent idea too.
And I would say that Missouri has recognized that need for growth, and they have implemented a growth model, you know, in the last year or so. And so, for example, even at Benton, all of my subgroups that were tested, that were accountable for on the MAP test, all made a 10% gain or more in mathematics, which is why we met AYP last year, in a sense, and held at that same improvement level because of that growth. So the state has started to recognize that, wow, we need to really track the progress of the kids and not just give them that set score. A lot of students in my building come from very impoverished homes, and they struggle, and we have to bring them a lot further than other students. And so I think it is important to recognize that growth.
Well, how are you managing that, though? I mean, if they're coming from disadvantaged backgrounds, on top of that, they're also coming into this new program. It sounds like you wouldn't have
actually... Because you know what they come with? They come with an eagerness to learn. It doesn't matter where they come from or what background they have or what experience they have. They're kids, and they want to learn. They want to know as much as they possibly can. Everything around them, it's a natural curiosity. All kids ask, why is the sky blue? Why is this that? Why? They always ask those questions. We've got to be willing to say, let's help you figure that out, but not just answer the question for you, but let's help you figure out how to answer that question. And be willing to take a step back and realize that some of those kids are coming in with questions that maybe my kid had when they were in 3, but this kid has when they're 8. Well, that's okay. What questions do you have right now, and how do we take you from this point further?
Hmm. And have those students, I mean, what have the standardized tests reflected? Have they been growing since STEM was instituted?
Well, this was only our first year as a STEM school, so we don't have anything to look at except for this next test, I suppose, and we do worry about it. I mean, it's a standardized test, and we're held accountable for it. So, yeah, my heart, you know, sinks a little bit every minute. I think about that test, I think, oh, gosh, I hope it's good, because if it's not, then people are going to assume that STEM's not working, and I don't want that to be the perception. I don't want people to think because our achievement scores aren't as high as they should be or they want them to be, that our STEM program isn't a good program, because we're doing some phenomenal things with kids right now in our building. Yeah. We're really excited about it.
And you have to look at motivation, too. You have to look at, you know, when you walk in the classrooms that I've been in and Benton, you look at the kids, they're excited about what they're doing. They're eager to learn. And I think that's something that we have to take into mm-hmm. account, not just where they are on the spectrum, but are they motivated to get better? Are they motivated to improve? Are they motivated to learn? And that's the thing I see happening there.
Troy Sandler, what advice would you have for Trey Hogg in terms of promoting this long-term growth in interdisciplinary education?
To stick with it. Following up on this kind of same line. I mean, even if the scores come back this year and there's a dip in scores rather than a rise in scores, you know, Troy knows better than I do. I mean, schools are complicated places, and we don't know that it's because they're implementing a STEM program that we see that dip. There's all kinds of things that go on in every classroom and in all the classrooms that make up the school. And so I think having a staff and a group of students that are committed to this direction that they're moving in is fantastic. And providing the supports for students and staff to keep moving in that direction, I think is the path towards success. There was a National Research Council report that came out several years ago that was looking at kind of specialized schools, STEM-focused schools, arts-focused schools, or pick your focus, magnet kinds of schools. And if the question was not, or well, if you went out and tried to answer the question, which of those schools is best? Well, they didn't disaggregate along the lines of, the STEM is better than the art school, but it was the schools that had buy-in from the faculty, that had buy-in from the students, that had buy-in from the parents, administrators, they had a common focus, they had a series of common goals. Those were the schools that were successful. So having that persistence, that perseverance, that focus, everyone was kind of coming together around kind of common goals, common issues. With this theme, that was the thread that really made for strong schools and transformative places for learning.
I'm glad you mentioned that mm-hmm. because this has been my fourth year at Benton, and the first two or three years at school, I did textbook what I learned in school, how to be a principal, textbook. I followed it. Well, let's work on the vision. Let's work on the mission. Let's work on getting us all on the same page. And I did that for the first few years, but it just didn't seem to stick. It didn't seem to work. And there were just a collective group of people who were wonderful people individually, but we couldn't seem to get on the same page. STEM got us all on the same page, whether we wanted to be or not. That was our focus then. That really just united my staff. United my families. I've got a PTA now. I haven't really had a PTA at Benton before, but we've got a strong PTA now who's working and pushing STEM forward as well. So it has been a really good piece that just kind of made it real cohesive and connected all of us.
And I think that's where we might have to end for today, unfortunately. That's it for today's Intersection. I'd like to thank our guests, Troy Sadler, Troy Hogg, and Craig Adams. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can also watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online by going to kbia.org and clicking the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to stream video, submit questions and comments, and participate in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all our past programs, including the full hours of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's show is produced by Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director, with production assistance from Danny Madison. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Raymond Tungakar. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.